and I'm in denial. And it don't take no x-ray to see right through my smile. I know I'll be on the go. And it ain't no drink out there that can numb my soul. Oh no. All we wanna do is take the chains off. All we wanna do is break the chains off, man. All we wanna do is be free. All we wanna do is be free. All we wanna do is take the chains off. All we wanna do is break the chains off, man. All we wanna do is be free. All we wanna do is be free. Can you tell me why? Every time I step outside, I see my niggas die. Kill my soul. Oh no. Say, all we want to do is take the chains off. All we want to do is take the chains off. All we want to do is be free. All we want to do is be free. All we want to do is take the chains off.
Good afternoon. I'm Cal Winslow, your host. Today we have the second in our series, Black Lives Matter, The Police and the People. Our program consists of four in-depth interviews broadcast here on KZYX every Wednesday this month at 1 p.m. Our guest today is Professor Alex Vitale. Alex is an associate professor of sociology at Brooklyn College, the City University of New York. He's the author of City of Disorder, How the Quality of Life Campaign Transformed New York Politics. He writes and speaks on issues of police and policing. His articles have been published in many places, including the New York Daily News, The Nation, Dissent, Gotham Gazette, and Al Jazeera America. Hello, Alex.
Hello, Cal.
How great to have you on. Alex, I wonder if I might just take a minute to introduce the subject. I think I've explained this to you. But the national issues last fall of policing, specifically the Michael Brown and Eric Garner cases, hit home here in Mendocino County when members of the girls' basketball team at Mendocino High School wore "I Can't Breathe" T-shirts in game warm-ups. And the reference, of course, was to Eric Garner's last words. Now, happily, the girls received much support from their school, the teachers, from parents, fans, and the community, but unfortunately also much criticism, and criticism of the movement they identified with as well. The Sheriff's Association published two critical articles, and a local paper inferred that the girls were naive, somehow uninformed, and more than that, said that Michael Brown was a thug and that the quite astonishing movement that erupted in Ferguson and then in the wake of the Garner decision was really nothing more than liberal hysteria. Sorry. Then, of course, the issue became international when the girls were banned from playing in Fort Bragg's high school annual holiday tournament. Coverage, interestingly, that was overwhelmingly supportive. So I'd like to use these programs to get to the bottom of some of these issues and to present listeners with a rather more connected take on reality. Alex, your subjects are policing, urban politics. How did you get to those? And maybe you could say a word. You made your way through this part of the country at one point, San Francisco.
That's right. In the late 80s and early 90s, I worked at the San Francisco Coalition on Homelessness. And really, I had gone there to do housing policy stuff to try to figure out how to develop very low-cost housing to try to, you know, reduce the homeless population. And as I was working there, more and more of the folks living out on the streets were coming in complaining to us about police harassment. And my boss at the time, Paul Bowden, who now runs the Western Regional Advocacy Project, asked me to look into it. So I started doing some street outreach and found that the problem seemed to be pretty significant. And so I did two things. On the one hand, I started learning more about policing. And on the other hand, I put together a team of volunteers, law students, outreach workers, concerned folks, and created a street watch program that went out, often with video cameras. This is before cell phone cameras. And tried to monitor what the police were doing. We then had a team of civil rights attorneys, including the ACLU of Northern California, who were working with us and looking at ways to push back on this. And it was at that point that I learned a lot more about the broken windows theory, which was driving a lot of this backlash. And that's really how I began to develop an expertise in policing.
And so you went from here to New York.
So then in the mid-90s, I went to school in New York, again, thinking that I was going to work on, like, urban public policy issues, housing and this, you know, economic development kind of stuff, looking at how cities could revitalize themselves in the face of the kind of bidding down of global neoliberal competition. And not long after getting there, Rudolph Giuliani was elected mayor on exactly the kind of get tough on the homeless, broken windows backlash politics. And all of a sudden, you know, everyone in New York was trying to figure that out. And I had lived through a version of this already and realized that I had a kind of comparative advantage, and ended up writing a dissertation that looked at the rise of this kind of quality of life backlash neoconservative politics, and then eventually wrote a book called City of Disorder that looked at this in great detail.
Now we're at, we're in the wake of first Ferguson, then the Staten Island decision. Maybe we could go to that. Coming from your background, what's the problem? What's your take on these events? And then maybe we can talk about the social movements that have followed.
Yeah, well, historically, you know, the motivation for resistance to policing practices has been driven by kind of singular high-profile incidents. Rodney King, Amadou Diallo, at least in recent memory. But what is true today and what was true in the buildup to the riots of the 60s is that the real problem tends to be a pervasive over-policing and discriminatory policing and heavy-handed policing of communities of color. But it is these singular incidents that create the kind of triggers or flashpoints that motivate the taking action, because it's very hard to take action around the everyday constant harassment. So what's been interesting to me is how quickly, especially here in New York with the Eric Garner case, it went from a conversation limited to police brutality to a broader conversation about over-policing and the reliance on this neoconservative broken windows theory approach to policing. And now it's become even more broad. It's become a kind of new civil rights movement type approach to say that, you know, there are fundamental issues of racial justice that are, you know, undermining American society, and policing is maybe the most well-known expression of that, but it can be seen in school failure, segregation, mass incarceration, et cetera. So it's been really remarkable to see in such a short period of time people immersing themselves in the minutiae of policing philosophies and becoming more expert at talking about things like predictive policing and broken windows policing and quality of life policing and militarized policing. And the public discourse has really shifted in important ways. And I think in some ways really analogous to what happened with the Occupy movement, where in a very short period of time, in response to people taking to the streets in a disruptive way, shifting the public debate in a really important way.
Maybe you could take us through a couple of the programs just so for people who aren't so familiar, we could get a better idea of what these programs look like. I think in New York, we could begin. What about Stop and Frisk? What was that all about?
Great. So Stop and Frisk is not a new tactic. It's something that's always been a part of policing. It basically says that when police have some kind of reason to suspect that someone may be up to no good, they have the ability to stop that person, question them, and if they feel it's necessary, conduct a kind of casual external search to make sure the person doesn't have a weapon on them that might be used to harm the officer in that circumstance. Now, as it was originally used and envisaged, it was supposed to be, you know, a very limited tactic to, like, deal with situations where, you know, a burglar alarm is going off and someone is walking down the street in an overcoat when it's 90 degrees outside. Okay, you have a crowbar under there. What's your reason for being out in the middle of the night while this burglar alarm's going on? What it became in New York, though, and other places, was something totally different, which was it became removed from any kind of specific reasonable suspicion and became a kind of blanket policy of indiscriminate searching of young men of color primarily in poor neighborhoods. So instead of having a few thousand stop, question, and frisks every year, or even 10,000 in a place like New York, we were in the hundreds of thousands, up to 500,000-600,000 stops a year. And for a young man of color in New York City, the likelihood of being stopped became, you know, in some cases, a monthly occurrence. And completely devoid of any kind of real reasonable suspicion. And this was tied directly or indirectly to a kind of broken windows approach to policing, which really said that what is needed to reduce crime is to micromanage the public behavior of so-called high-risk populations. That the way to reduce crime, rebuild communities, was to have the police act as kind of moral enforcers of a kind of public civility. And Stop and Frisk became a way for the police to kind of get into the business of every young person on the streets through a kind of constant low-level harassment. Are you carrying drugs? Are you drinking in public? Are you loitering where we don't want you to stand? Are you hanging out with a group of people making too much noise? And sometimes this involved enforcement against things that aren't really illegal, but were just considered to be disorderly. And the broken windows theory said, go for it, to the police. So stop, question, and frisk became the most well-known and widely experienced aspect of a broader shift in policing. And fortunately, here in New York, there was a kind of tipping point where people in a lot of these communities said, this is too much. 90% of the people who were stopped didn't even get a ticket, much less get arrested, have guns on them. It was so clearly indiscriminate. It was so clearly targeting primarily people who had done absolutely nothing wrong except to be, you know, black and brown and a young person. And so there were a series of lawsuits, large-scale demonstrations, and it became an issue in the mayoral election. And while Bill de Blasio did not say he was going to end the practice, he did signal quite clearly that he thought it was being used indiscriminately and excessively. And in fact, the number of stop and frisks has gone down significantly over the last year.
And so Eric Garner, now he was stopped for in the broken windows theory, is that right, for selling loose cigarettes?
That's right. So he was not really targeted for a stop, question, and frisk. He was targeted for a more specific, what we sometimes call quality of life offense or broken windows offense, which was he hung out on a commercial street and sold loose cigarettes to people. Usually people who couldn't scrape enough money together to buy a whole pack of cigarettes at a time. Cigarettes are quite expensive in New York due to the number of extra taxes. And for poor people, it's a real burden. And so there is a market for the selling of these loose cigarettes. And this is a common thing throughout the city. But some local residents and merchants complained about this loitering. And from the very highest levels of the police department, there were orders to go and get rid of this behavior. And in fact, the chief of department said that, you know, he was personally involved in driving the policing that led directly to Eric Garner's death. So this was not a decision made by some random patrol officer. This was official policy from the very top of the department to aggressively target and criminalize this kind of behavior. And so they were there to arrest him for selling loose cigarettes, even though they didn't actually have anyone in custody who had bought said cigarettes, which were prepared to test, which would have been necessary to get a real prosecution. But that wasn't the point. The point was a process of constant harassment, of ticketing, arrest and release, arrest and put them through the system in hopes of driving them out of the location. And this was the strategy that was used to get rid of the so-called squeegee men in the early 90s as well. An almost extra-legal, outside of the real legal system, approach to dealing with what were conceived to, with what were considered to be these kinds of quality of life problems.
And what do you mean, Alex, when you say arrest, put them through the system?
We're supposedly not supposed to punish a person for a criminal offense until they've been proven guilty. But for low-level offenses, the process of arresting a person, usually holding them overnight in very unpleasant temporary situations, and then having them appear before a judge the next day, is itself often the punishment that is meted out, and a punishment that is totally at the discretion of the police. So imagine getting arrested in the middle of the day, being put in a police van, and sometimes driven around for a couple of hours while they collect additional people, right, with in handcuffs, no food, no bathroom, no water, then taken to a local precinct where you're placed in a temporary holding cell, usually, again, with no food or water, usually no access to a phone or very limited if you're lucky, then fingerprinted, then put in another van, taken to a holding facility at one of the court systems, often spending the night in a van, on a bench, something like that, then move to a court pen, then finally seeing a judge who usually, because it's such a low-level charge, releases the person as soon as they appear before them, either dismissing the charges, putting them on a kind of six-month probation, et cetera. So these are not people who are some real threat to society. They're almost all released, but they have received often 24 hours of punishment, and the feeling among the police is that that in itself is supposed to be the deterrent to getting people, you know, to stop this low-level disorderly behavior.
And it's lots of people. Can you quantify it at all?
Yes, well, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of arrests a year for these low-level infractions. Plus, hundreds of thousands of summonses, which are basically like traffic tickets, but in most cases require that the person show up in court. You can't just write a check and put it in the mail. So that mm-hmm. means taking time off of work, standing in line, being churned through the court system, sometimes having to make additional appearances, especially if you are in fact innocent or assert your innocence, then that means more punishment, in essence, before then possibly being found innocent. So there, it's a real kind of catch-22 situation.
Now, Alex, let me pause for a moment here. This is KZYX, Mendocino County Community Radio. I'm your host, Cal Winslow. Our program today is Black Lives Matter, the Police and the People. And our guest is Professor Alex Vitale. Alex is a professor of sociology at Brooklyn College at the City University of New York. Well, Alex, what about the results? Did crime go down? Did these policies work?
Well, crime is down internationally. So, of course, police officials, wherever crime has gone down, have tried to say that whatever they were doing is the reason for the crime drop. But the fact is that most of these cities were doing different things. Cities that never heard of the broken windows theory have had dramatic crime drops. Cities that chose completely different approaches to crime have had dramatic crime drops. So there's very little support for the idea that broken windows policing is the reason for the crime drop. Even academics who feel that, such as Franklin Zimmering at Berkeley, he argued, well, maybe part of the crime drop in New York was because of policing, but he said it had to do with hotspot policing and Comstat, and it had nothing to do with broken windows theory policing. Mm. So very thin evidence and a lot of counter evidence against this. Now, what I and others have, some others have argued, is that you can use these techniques to get rid of disorder. Yes, if you go in and arrest homeless people sleeping in a park every day, they will eventually go somewhere else, possibly the jail system for an extended period. But that has nothing to do with serious crime. And that's the trick here. So yes, we can use intensive, aggressive, and invasive policing to drive out squeegee men and street-level drug dealers possibly, but there's no evidence that that is connected to a reduction in serious crime.
And just before we leave this, so what can you say or what can be said about what happened to Eric Garner that day?
Well, I think that the most important thing about the Eric Garner case is that it was a product of over-policing, that the police should have had nothing to do with whatever was going on there, that if there was selling of illegal cigarettes, that should have been handled administratively. Someone could have gone and issued him a citation of some kind, but that should have nothing to do with the police. Just like when a legitimate seller of cigarettes sells to minors or sells bootleg untaxed cigarettes, that is an administrative issue. There are civilian enforcement agents who can write tickets, et cetera. So we need to move away from this approach of trying to criminalize our way out of every problem.
And now you have another case there. Is it Akai Gurley?
Akai Gurley. That's a different kind of case. It is related, though, because the officers were not engaged in any specific enforcement action, but what they were doing is looking for things to criminalize, low-level things, people smoking marijuana in the stairwell, loitering, things like that. But the mindset of the police has become so aggressive and so fearful in some ways that the officers were walking up the stairwells with their guns drawn, with their fingers on the trigger, so that when someone stumbles into a poorly lit stairwell, the possibility of an accidental shooting is right there. And this was not the first time this had happened. And so that's a very troubling indication of this completely misguided mindset of the police, and also, you know, raises the question of, is policing really the best way to deal with the problems that public housing residents are experiencing? For instance, you know, why was the stairwell poorly lit? Why did this young man and his girlfriend take the stairs instead of the elevator? Well, because the elevator wasn't working properly. You know, if the conditions in these facilities were better, this might reduce some of the problems, but also the concentrated, isolated poverty in these places, the disconnect between the formal economy and conditions in these neighborhoods, and the racialized nature of that economic dislocation, you know, all contribute to the production of problems and the inability of communities to regulate behavior through informal mechanisms.
Well, I wonder if we could come back to that in a few minutes. I wanted to ask you a very basic question, and if you wouldn't mind, take your time with this. You must have to deal with this in your classes. So what are the police? Could you tell us a little bit about what are the police? What are they all about?
Yeah, so I've been, you know, thinking a lot about this, especially lately. I'm working on a new book for Verso Press that will include what I call a functional history of the police. The police, as we think of them today, is a pretty recent phenomena. They've been around for less than 200 years. And what I found is really three driving forces that were essential in the creation of police forces. Normally, when we think of the first police forces, we think of England, London, the Bobbies that were named after Sir Robert Peel, Robert Bobby, etc. And the traditional story is that, street crime and disorder were a problem. We needed a professional force that was embedded in the community that would have legitimacy to deal with crime problems. But my reading of this history is quite a bit different. First of all, Sir Robert Peel came up with his ideas about policing not in London, but in Ireland. He was part of the colonial administration of English-occupied Ireland. And so colonialism played a major role in the conceptualization of the police. And we see this also in Africa, in Southeast Asia, and in Latin America, as Western powers move in to colonize areas. They start with a military approach, and as soon as territory is conquered, they then bring in often local people under Western command to act as local police, to give them a more nuanced and legitimate militarized presence in these communities. And their main goal in these situations is not really to deal with crime, it's to make sure that uprisings don't occur, to keep an eye on the local population, and to try to protect the rights of the white colonizers. Now, in London, we weren't dealing with colonization. What you were dealing with was working class mobilization. The early 1800s was a period of increasing industrialization, and along with that, immiseration and labor unrest. So there was a growing number of strikes and riotous behavior associated with the growing working class, and the only tool that the London authorities had for dealing with those problems were basically the military. And the military, the main tool that they had for putting down a strike or a riot was to line up with rifles and fire into a crowd. And this often just exacerbated the problem, you know, created bigger political problems. So the police were designed as a tool for managing labor unrest with billy clubs and arrest rather than shooting into a crowd. And in fact, if we look at like the development of state police in the United States 100 years ago, 125 years ago, state police forces were largely created for the same reason, which was that local authorities could not be counted upon to sufficiently repress labor uprisings, miners, industrial workers, etc., often in small towns where the local police were sympathetic. So they needed a police force that wasn't loyal to the local population that could be called in to put down these labor uprisings. And that's why state police forces were created in places like Pennsylvania and Ohio and New York, etc. So we've got colonization, we've got labor unrest, and then the third is the origins of policing in slavery. In the American South, policing emerges out of slave patrols. In fact, I would argue the first police force in the United States was created in Charleston, South Carolina. Often scholars don't include that example precisely because they saw it as having to do with slavery and thus not a modern police force. But I think that is exactly the point, that policing does develop, at least in part, out of the need to control slave populations. And Charleston is the obvious example because Charleston had a very particular form of slavery. In the rural areas, you had plantations with very tight control of movements, etc. But in Charleston itself, most slave owners rented their slaves out as workers in a variety of occupations, carpenters, painters, seamstresses, and even industrial workers. And they had freedom of movement and even earned wages on top of what the slave owner was paid. So the police were needed to manage this mobile slave population. And so those, in my mind, are the three sort of functional origins of policing. And what distinguishes the police, basically, from other institutions of government is that they are the institution that uses force to manage inequality. And while we hear a lot of talk about public safety and crime reduction, if you look at what police really do minute by minute during the day, what they really spend their time doing has very little to do with real crime and a lot more to do with managing difficult populations. Basically the symptoms of inequality. And the broken windows theory is a perfect example of that.
So here's a question, another one, a tough one, because we get in trouble just for asking the question. Alex, what about racism? Are the police racist?
Well, here's the interesting thing, is that we have now in the U.S. a system of over-policing and mass incarceration. Totally out of step with the rest of the developed world. You know, millions of people in the prison system, you know, overwhelmingly people of color disproportionately. And that system to operate does not require that any individual police officer have racially biased motivations. It doesn't require that prosecutors or judges have racially biased motivations, though clearly some do. It is a system that is cloaked in a lot of race-neutral language, but I would argue was designed by elected officials, at least in part, if not in large part, to deal with racial inequality. And we have a lot of evidence now, especially from the Nixon White House, that, for instance, the war on drugs never had anything to do with public safety, reducing the negative impacts of drugs. It was a way for Nixon to operationalize a cynical politics of race by putting federal law enforcement at the center of crime control, targeting African Americans, student radicals, radical activists, etc. And the war on drugs is really at the center of the rise of mass incarceration, militarized policing, and the just general expansion of the criminal justice system. And it is at root based on a kind of cynical politics of race. But it doesn't require the police to think in those terms.
And the system itself, is it a racist system?
Well, systems aren't people. You know, a system doesn't have a motive. That's like saying a hurricane chose to hit someplace, right?
Right.
So systems, but the designers of systems have motives. Now, systems don't always end up looking like what was intended, right? They can have a logic and a momentum of their own. And the people that work with them, within them, do play a role in shaping them. And I would argue in this case, the motivations were racial in origin, either intently or benignly. And many of the actors within those systems have accentuated the racialized character of it. For instance, you know, you can't, in a place like New York, there's almost no enforcement of the drug laws in white communities. And this is true in much of the country, where anytime the police narcotics unit is like, we should do a sting operation, they go to a black or brown community. Now, I know in Mendocino, the history is a little different. Mendocino's experienced the drug war quite intently at various times, from helicopters and SWAT teams and all of that. But that Mendocino has not historically been a particularly racially diverse place. And so that may be part of why it's a place where we've seen whites targeted to such a high degree.
And you said perceived. So at least in Ferguson, it seems that there was a perception of racism. Is that right, or why?
Well, you know, we know, for instance, that there were a couple of really bad dynamics in Ferguson. One is that, you know, the majority of police were white, the majority of the community was black, that the policing intently focused on the black community more than the white community in terms of traffic infractions and drug enforcement, et cetera. But would diversifying the Ferguson Police Department or giving a lot of diversity training to the Ferguson Police Department solve the problems of over-policing and mass incarceration? And I would argue no. That we've got a lot of research now that shows that diversity on police departments does not particularly reduce the pattern of arrest, the use of force, et cetera. So officers are embedded in an institutional framework that really limits their discretion in important ways, and we really don't have much reason to believe that a more diverse police force is going to fight against those institutional imperatives.
And the New York Police Department is considerably more diverse than it used to be. Is that the case now?
That's definitely true. That's definitely true.
This is KZYX, Mendocino County Community Radio, and I'm your host today, Cal Winslow. And our program is Black Lives Matter, the Police and the People. It's part of a series this month. And our guest today is Professor Alex Vitale, who's an associate professor of sociology at Brooklyn College in New York. There seems to be, there's another problem, and that's the problem as thinking about it when we were talking about racism. There seems to be a problem when it comes to criticizing, I guess would be the word, the police. It seems to be something that for many people we're not supposed to do. I wonder where that comes from.
Yes, well, I wrote a short piece online for The Nation recently asking, you know, what does it mean to be anti-police? If I call up and complain that the swings don't work in the playground, does that make me anti-parks? If I, you know, complain that my garbage isn't being picked up, am I anti-sanitation? Somehow, policing is a realm in which criticism is not allowed. That you can't, that there's just no space for even constructive criticism. That the police and have constructed a kind of politics around their job that is, you know, defensive, hostile, and aggrieved. And in that way, it really ties into the broader rise of kind of right-wing politics in the U.S. It's interesting how, you know, a Republican Party, the Tea Party, these are parties of privilege. The people in them tend to be much more privileged. And yet, there's been research that shows these people all feel aggrieved, that somehow everyone is working against them, even though they're by and large the disproportionate beneficiaries of you know, American economic and political power. And the police feel the same way. They feel that everyone is out to get them. Part of this has to do with the nature of their job, that they are using force against the population, and I think that this makes them very defensive because they see a lot of hostility directed towards them in their day-to-day work. And I also think this has been made worse by this idea, again, linked to the broken windows theory, that the police are responsible for, you know, everything good that's happening in society, that the revitalization of urban areas and the crime reduction is all because of the police and because of their moralizing approach to public behavior. And therefore, to question them about the way they do their job is to say that you're in favor of unleashing, you know, murder and mayhem on the streets. It's also tied to the culture wars. I think the police, many police, regardless of race, view poor communities of color as morally corrupt, and especially the people within them who commit crime, and that the root of social problems is moral corruption, and that really the only way to solve that is through a moralizing police force. And anyone who challenges that is naive and is just enabling bad behavior.
Yeah, well, our basketball girls here at Mendocino High School were certainly called naive, and after their first time they wore their I Can't Breathe t-shirts for warm-ups, there were two responses that were posted on the Mendocino County Sheriff's Association website, and this one wasn't signed by anyone. It's not really important to us who wrote it, but it was part of the response that the girls got, and let me just read it out and see if it fits in with your experience elsewhere. The posting reads, unsigned, "So while you sit there sympathizing with the criminals and becoming part of the problem by saying hands up, don't shoot, or I can't breathe, and preaching an ignorant and biased agenda against an individual who would willingly die for you in an instant, no matter if you like them or not, while you sit there with hate and distaste over the fact that they are all, quotes, all racist, unquotes, and they can hide behind the badge and without mercy murder anyone they please, while you sit there and bask in all the hatred that has been ignited this past year, understand that they will always, emphasis, be there to help you. Does that sound familiar?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, that is all quite common sort of boilerplate ideology. But it's, you know, it's just, again, a sign of this sense of being under assault and creating this kind of mythic understanding of the police. At the same time police say that, they also say their number one imperative every day is to get home safe. That, in fact, they are not prepared to die for you in a second. Take these mass school shootings like Columbine, et cetera, where police SWAT teams were there immediately and refused to go in and confront the shooters because they said it was too dangerous for them. So this is kind of nonsense. Yes, police officers risk their lives, and yes, they do at times engage in heroic behavior, but mostly what they do is engage in the day-to-day banal criminalization of poor people of color in many parts of the country. That this is what the police really spend their time doing, and that is the major impact of what they do. And the fact that any attempt at all to raise this as an issue in the political sphere is considered to be an attack on them is just preposterous. No other part of government is allowed to accuse anyone who questions them of being in favor of killing cops, basically. You know, this is just a dramatic overreaction and a failure of civilian leadership to assert control over a very important but potentially dangerous part of government. I mean, our, you know, civil libertarians of the left and right should always have a deep skepticism about the armed forces of the state. And somehow the police have gotten a pass on this. And I think we need to have a fundamental reexamination of what it is exactly we're asking the police to do. And we should look for alternatives to relying on the police to deal with every kind of social problem in society. We need to find civilianized alternatives. We need to find alternatives that don't rely on uniformly punitive sanctions to try to change people's behavior.
I should add that in response to these statements from the Sheriff's Department, the Mendocino girls made it very clear that they were not anti-police, that they recognized what the police did and that it was in fact courageous in many instances. That their letter was read out here on our previous program. Now, Alex, one last thing that's really come out in this last period of time, and I think Ferguson had a lot to do with it again, and that's the issue of what's been called the militarization of the police. And of course, I just read in the paper that there's going to be a new unit in New York City armed with machine guns. What's going on there?
We already have officers with machine guns in New York, and this would be a dramatic expansion of those counterterrorism forces. There are some huge question marks about this. When it was first announced, the commissioner said that among their duties would be to help with the policing of large contentious protests. Well, that sent off a lot of alarm bells, and I have a piece on my own website, alex-vitali.info, that basically says, you know, this is a classic example of the dynamic of mission creep contributing to the militarization of policing. So SWAT teams were formed in the 70s to deal with extremely rare violent exchanges with criminals, but quickly found they didn't have any such incidents to respond to, or a very small number. But with an infusion of federal drug war dollars, they expanded dramatically and shifted their focus almost entirely to fighting the war on drugs. They almost never deal with barricaded suspects, and even less terrorists. So to take terrorism threats, which in a place like New York are not, you know, negligible, something that's a very real concern, but to then expand the mission of those forces to dealing with protest is exactly this kind of dangerous mission creep. And I think the vast majority of SWAT teams in this country are totally unnecessary, have contributed to a massive war mentality among the police. And we could see in Ferguson, for instance, the way in which the militarized response to the protests probably created more violence, more disorder, more property destruction, not less. And I'll just recommend Radley Balko's book, The Rise of the Warrior Cop, for a really detailed history of this problem.
Okay, well, we have some time left. Alex, what's going to happen? Where are we going to go? And maybe both for the movement, I could ask you about that, and then what about the police themselves? I did want to ask you the especially, well, not just in New York, all over the place, the protests in the streets following the Garner decision were quite diverse. Is that something new or interesting that's happening?
Yes, it is interesting and it is new. I think we can trace the origins of this in from two directions. One is the response to the killing of Trayvon Martin, which also engendered some large, spontaneous, disruptive protests, but that didn't last very long. Also important was the Occupy movement, which I think trained and emboldened a generation of young activists towards disruptive street action. And what we saw on the streets, I think, in a lot of places around the country, was a coming together of those two tendencies and activists and sets of experiences to produce a kind of multiracial, direct action-focused response that has been very powerful. And while there's been some a reduction in activity in the winter months, you know, we have several inches of snow and ice on the ground here in New York and through much of the Northeast, I think that these forces are still organizing behind the scenes. The meetings are happening, speak outs, trainings, et cetera, and I think we're likely to see an increase in activity in the spring.
You know, there are people, I'm sure many listeners here, who think that the police offer them protection and who feel that they need protection. Now, what about that? And what about the ideas that are being put forth about what we might call reform, the video cams, community policing, more diversity, et cetera?
So I also wrote a piece for The Nation called We Don't Just Need Nicer Cops, We Need Fewer Cops. Now, this is not to say that crime and disorder aren't real problems that people should be concerned about. You know, especially I live in a city. I'm raising kids in New York City. I want to, you know, have some level of safety. The question is whether or not an armed police force is the best possible way of producing that safety. and whether or not there are things that we are asking the police to do that really don't contribute to that public safety. And I would say focusing on training and increased diversity and even police cameras, all the things that are included in, you know, Obama's new budget, are not going to help with that. That instead we need this top-to-bottom rethink of policing. And for me, that has to start with two fundamental things. One is the war on drugs, and the other is broken windows policing. You know, for 40 years we've had a war on drugs, and drugs are cheaper, of higher quality, and more widely available than they've ever been. And the militarized policing response to drugs has been a 100% total failure. It has not reduced the impact of drugs on society, and there's no high school kid in this country that can't get their hands on illegal drugs today. So we got to completely rethink our approach to drugs and just take police completely out of that business. The prohibitionist approach to drugs has been a worse failure than the prohibitionist approach to alcohol. And then for broken windows policing, we need to try to find ways to empower communities and civilian authorities to deal with disorder problems without relying on people with guns and handcuffs and pepper spray and whatnot. And we have some great examples out there. We need to get the cops out of the schools and instead develop restorative justice programs that have been proven to work to increase safety much better than police do in schools, and quit criminalizing our young people. We need to invest in community violence reduction strategies like the Cure Violence approach that uses respected people in the community to go out, work with young people, try to put them on a positive path, try to interrupt the cycles of retributive violence that are so often associated with gangs and gun use. These programs can make a big difference. We need to rethink our approach to the mentally ill. Police are not well trained, and it's just not in the nature of their job to deal as effectively with these kinds of calls as they could, and too often the results are incredibly tragic. We need to do what other countries are doing, have civilian crisis response teams so that when you call 911 about a mentally ill people, someone with real training shows up, not someone with a gun. So those are just some examples of real alternatives that are focused on making us safer without all of the negative collateral consequences of aggressive, militarized police.
Well, this has been very interesting and very informative, and I hope it will lead to discussions, whether listeners agree or not. And I hope that it will lead to a, you know, a much more thoughtful response to our young people when they protest here and elsewhere in the future. But really, Alex, I want to thank you again. It's been a pleasure. I wish you good luck in your work, and we'll look forward to your new book. What's it going to be called?
Well, we don't have a title yet, but people can follow me on Twitter, at A. Vitale, to stay abreast of my writings.
Okay, thanks very much, and I'll be back next week at the same time. Listeners, thank you for tuning in, and good afternoon.